This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
State area, streaming live at WBAI.org. Listener-sponsored community radio since 1960. 64 degrees is the temperature. Coming up next is Women, Body, and Soul with Natalie Tanderway. Stay tuned.
Body and Soul, the second of a two-part series on fatherhood, featuring Janetta Rose Barris and her book, Whatever Happened to Daddy's Little Girl, The Impact of Fatherlessness on Black Women. Later in the show, why does the verb mother have such a different connotation from the verb father? We'll discuss the reinvention of dad and how current concepts of masculinity and fatherhood undermine families with Professor Mark Anthony Neal and hip-hop musician Bomani Arma.
Is feeling fine.
This is your host, Natalie Tandiwe. You're listening to Women, Body, and Soul, WBAI 99.5 FM, New York City, streaming live at WBAI.org. This is our second Father's Day special. Today's guest is Janetta Rose Barris, discussing her book, Whatever Happened to Daddy's Little Girl, The Impact of Fatherlessness on Black Women. Ms. Rose Barris is an author, columnist for the Washington Examiner, host of D.C. sister station WPFW show, D.C. Politics with Janetta. Welcome, Janetta.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Thanks so much for joining us to discuss your work. I want to just jump right into this book. It's it looks like a small short book, but it's very dense. There's a lot of information and a lot of emotional intensity to the book.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things you say to us in the beginning of the book is you tell us your story, and you say you have three fathers, all of whom abandoned you. Explain to us how you came to have three fathers and how and when they entered and exited your life.
Well, there was the man who my mother was married to, who for more than 20 years I thought was actually my biological father, Bill. And then there was my biological father, John, whom I subsequently met when I was about 37, 38 years old. But then there was a man whom my mother lived with for a time when I was a young girl, around 5, 6 years old, Noel, who was really the person I felt the greatest fatherly love to, and who, when he exited my life, I think it was the most devastating loss. It's a loss that even now, at this age, this stage in my life, I still long to reconnect with him, even after reconnecting with my biological father.
Mm. In the book, you do talk about this struggle to recover from your father's having left, and you say one burning question remained: what kind of person rejects a child?
Yes.
And the word reject, it cuts to the core of this wound of abandonment. I think sometimes because the word abandonment has become almost psych speak, it's easy to kind of check out when someone says that word and not really think about what goes under that, but that question, what kind of person rejects a child, completely frames it differently. And I'm just wondering, did any of the people in your family ever come to understand that you were moving through life feeling deeply rejected in your own core?
I don't think they understood that until I actually wrote this book, until they had a chance to read the book.
Mm.
I think that many parents believe that children are so resilient, and they are. That every scar that they experience as a child is somehow vanishes as they become adults or in adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
Despite all of the psychological studies that we know of that are to the contrary, I think parents at the time, because if they really, if they really had to deal with the fact that the consequences of their actions may in fact scar their children, I think some parents might be completely paralyzed. Mm-hmm. Others might be a little bit more thoughtful about how they themselves live their lives as it relates to their children. But in each case, it would burden, I think it burdens the parents to the point that they wouldn't move as move fast as they do in their own personal lives, not realizing that they're having this effect. So for me, I think my mother and my father, sister, my siblings, and everyone else in my family were so busy leading their own lives and doing their own thing and trying to get past their own challenges and obstacles that they had very little time to stop to think, how is this affecting this girl or this particular child? And so, you know, when my mother actually understood the depth of the pain, it was astounding to her.
Mm. You know, you say some of the things you say make me think of other things. One, you know, in your talking about how we perceive children to go through these experiences like being divorced, separation, being left by parents, it's almost as if at this point in our culture of child rearing, children are very much at the external center of our attention. We buy them so much. We center activities around them. But, you know, which is that is a shift from, you know, children should be seen and not heard. But yet at the same time, so little attention is spent on their inner lives. And really asking that question, how does something impact them internally and how will that carry throughout the rest of their lives? And your experience really speaks to that, you know, that need to ask that question as someone who cares about children or is parenting children, is what is happening to your child's inner life and how can you put that at the center of things? But the other thing I wanted to ask about is what changes you saw in your relationships with people, you know, obviously that inner core of people like your mother and your sisters, after this revelation that you make in this book, and also I'm sure through this process of writing the book about how you were feeling pained and wounded. Ms. Barris? Oh, I think we might be having some technical problems. Our engineer is going to step in and make sure that we still have Ms. Barris on the line, and we'll just have one moment of music while he does that.
Okay.
Oh, there you are.
I can hear you.
You're back in. So I was just asking how this impacted your relationships with the other people in your life who were at the center of your life once they understood this about you, this sense of rejection.
I think that for my mother, it gave her a greater insight into the kind of deep thinker I was as a child. I think that we don't understand that while children are processing on a daily basis, but the problem is that they don't always have the language to articulate to adults what they're processing and what their conclusions and analyses are. And so for my mother, at that point, she realized, she understood why I dressed the way I did in junior high school, where I didn't want to adorn myself at all. Mm-hmm. She understood my real need to kind of connect emotionally with a male when I became a teen. And then the tension that I had with her because I blamed her. And so there was a loss of this relationship that she and I had. So all of that came together for her. And what also came together for me was to understand that she really had done the best she could do. And it helped me to understand also all the relationships I had with men. It was not always the man's fault. I had, you know, these are dogs. This is a nothing guy. This is this and this and this. Mm. You know, and just like throwing darts at them 24 hours a day. And it helped me to understand that probably in 60% of the cases, it was me and not them, that I had developed, this, kind of aversion to being close and to making a commitment, and that I was sabotaging my own relationships with men, but I was also sabotaging my relationships with other people as well. I realized, you know, I was thinking that it was all about men, but it was really also about relationships in general. There were few women that I had close relationships with. I hadn't really been a joiner. I didn't become a member of groups because I was so fearful of being rejected. And so the book and the understanding of this, how this rejection sort of permeates in everything, helped me to assess my past and put me on a better path for interacting with everyone, in, especially myself, as I moved forward.
And, you know, I'm curious about that. What specific changes did you see or did you consciously make in your interactions with people where you can say this was Jonetta before this revelation and this is Jonetta after?
Well, I was a very angry woman, and inexplicable anger. You know, you just had to look at me the wrong way and I was all in your face. and so you know, so that I got a real grasp on where that anger came from, and so that I didn't just throw it around so generously without, you know, without reason. The other thing was that I began to, when I became fearful in a relationship, I started asking myself, what is this about? Is this daddy? Is this this person? Is this you? You know, what is causing this? And, you know, I used to tell people when I went around speaking, I would tell people, I'd use the blue sock syndrome. It's like, you know, a guy wears blue socks all the time and then one day he comes in with red socks and you immediately jump on 50 questions. Why are you wearing red socks? Where did you get the red socks? Who went with you to buy red socks? And you're ready to leave the relationship because the person has stopped wearing blue socks.
Right, so it's a point of conflict becomes a point of exit.
Exactly. And so I began to grapple with that so that every time there was a change in the rhythm of a relationship, it didn't spell, you know, there wasn't an exit sign on that, you know. And so those were just some of the things. And then it's a thing of just being comfortable with who you are, because for a long time you carry around this notion that you're not lovable. You're not the kind of person that someone would love. You begin to believe this with the kind of fervent zeal that one would have for a religious belief, and so you can't even fathom that someone would really love you. And so you begin to, at least for me, I began to really look at myself and judge myself as a lovable person, worthy of love, and so that helped me to begin to better appreciate myself. And even as I wrote the book, I will tell you, Natalie, one of the things that I still grapple with is this superwoman thing.
Right.
And I know African-American women especially are guilty of this. We think we can do everything. When I was writing the book, and I think I don't know if I say this in the book, but when I was writing the book, I was diagnosed. I had my first mammogram, rather, and there was a lump.
I remember that story, and you talk about it. Story, it's, you tell it so quickly that I actually had to reread it, because you talk about going, a man friend, or the man, your partner at the time, offering to take you to the hospital and take you back, and your insistence that you will do this alone, and that moment of walking out after a biopsy and stepping out from the curb to hail a cab, it's just so... It's so brutal.
It's weird. It's ridiculous is what it is. But it was my fear that this person, at this moment in time when I didn't know whether I had breast cancer or not, turns out it was benign, but at that moment I was fearful that this person would just reject me. You know, first off, I was getting a cut in my breast. So I didn't really, you know, I didn't really know how he would, like, perceive me physically. But I also psychologically didn't trust that he would be there for me because, you know, like, they're never there for you. You know, and I'm writing the book. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
So even as I was writing the book, I was processing this kind of sense of rejection, unworthiness, and fear of rejection and distrust. I was processing it, and by the time I finished the book, thank God, I had a real good handle on it. But it was still an issue as I was writing the book.
And I just want to remind listeners that this is 99.5 FM, WBAI Pacifica Radio New York, also streaming live online at WBAI.org. I'm your host, Natalie Tondiwe. This is Women, Body, and Soul. And our guest today is Jeanetta Rose Barris. We're talking about her book, Whatever Happened to Daddy's Little Girl, The Impact of Fatherlessness on Black Women. You know, in your ongoing research on fatherlessness, I'm curious, what answers did you actually find to that question, what kind of person rejects a child?
Well, I think that, when I started doing, because I did a follow-up to the Whatever Happened to Daddy's Little Girl,
yes.
I did a book, Bridges Reuniting Daughters and Daddies. And I began in the first book to explore the male side of it. In the second book, I explored it even more. Like, what happens to a father? Do they really just decide, you're not worth it, I'm leaving? In some instances, I think there are some fathers who actually make that decision. But most of the men that I spoke with as I was doing both of these books told their own stories of how they were pushed out of their children's lives and how they themselves felt unworthy and loss of their sense of manhood and masculinity because they could not take care of their own children and especially their daughters.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, I do take the male perspective in a few chapters in Whatever Happened to Daddy's Little Girl,
mm-hmm.
So that you see a man who is with his daughter and his wife decides that she doesn't want to be with him anymore,
mm-hmm.
and she's taking the child with her, and the
mm-hmm.
changes he goes through to maintain that relationship. So I think there was the thought in me that these men just leave without any concern,
mm-hmm.
but that's not always the case. And so I think that there are men who leave without any concern, for sure. But there are men who leave because they don't feel they have the economic capability of taking care of a child, the emotional capability, or they get into a bad relationship with the mother,
mm-hmm.
and they just can't negotiate that in a way where they can maintain their relationships with their daughters or
mm.
with their sons even. I know that most of the men that I talked to who had daughters were devastated by the fact that they could not maintain their relationships with their daughters because they perceived those relationships in a much different way than they did their relationships with their boys,
mm.
which I found fascinating. But there was this kind of real deeper emotional connection with their daughters because it's a special, really special relationship that men have with their daughters.
Mm.
And it just like it's a very special relationship that I think mothers have with their sons, that we always think about same gender child rearing.
Right.
But the cross-gender child rearing is so important to each person, to the parent and the parent's continued growth, and to the child.
Mm-hmm. You seem to, and I read the book very closely, and there's this piece where you seem to criticize feminism for defining fathers as disposable and encouraging women to have no expectations of fathers or to dismiss them. Yet when I read through the book, in the majority of the cases of the fatherlessness that you examine with us, the mothers were faced with their children's fathers being harmful to them or to the children. You know, there was abuse, addiction, or just checking out of the family. And I'm just wondering, how do you reconcile this attempt at escaping or protecting from harm on the mother's part with the notion that it's the fault of the mothers and feminism when fathers leave?
Well, let me just clarify something, because in only one case was there a situation where there was a kind of abuse or harm to a child.
Mm-hmm.
In my case, even with my own father, my own biological father, my mother indicated that he was abusive to her. And I will say this to any mother. sometimes the relationship a mother has with a father isn't necessarily the relationship the child will have with the father.
Absolutely.
And that mothers very often don't allow those relationships to develop because of the relationship that they themselves have with the father. So that I fault mothers with. Mm-hmm. But if there is a, I will say that if there is a case where a child is in a situation where the child can be harmed, then the mother has the right to withdraw the child from a situation like that, or to require that there is some custodial relationship when the father is visiting the child, so that mm-hmm. a grandparent or a family friend or someone is in that home or in that environment with the father and the child. But I wouldn't necessarily dismiss a relationship simply because the father has been was addicted to drugs, was at one time a domestic abuser.
Mm-hmm.
These are issues that have to be negotiated, even as the father tries to build a relationship with his child and with his daughter, unless the father is at that moment using drugs.
Mm-hmm. In the book, you see yourself repeating the cycle of fatherlessness in your daughter's life when you are a mother. And I'm just wondering, did you feel that this was an inevitability of having been abandoned by your fathers and how that played out in your life?
I think that there are patterns of behavior and psychology that we subconsciously hold on to. You know, much of what I talk about in this book is a subconscious psychology that I'm asking people to stop for a moment and think about your behavior, reflect on your own life, and see how this father absence has affected you. And so if you haven't done that, mm-hmm. you are likely to pass on certain preconceptions that maybe false. For example, I mentioned early in our conversation that, you know, there's this general perception that men are dogs. You know, we my daddy left me, so all men are dogs. And so then you begin to treat all men like dogs, and ha ha ha, surprise, they respond like dogs, okay? Mm-hmm. Because that's how you're treating them. And so then you pass on that whole notion of what a man is to your child and to both your daughters and your sons. And they then incorporate that in their thinking and their behavior. And so the cycle continues. And so at some point you've got to stop it. You've got to come to grips with your behavior so that negative behavior that was built around rejection and fear and the sense of unworthiness and rage and anger is not communicated either directly or indirectly to your children.
Mm. And I'm just curious from your observation, how have your daughter and father moved through recovery from that rupture in their relationship that you describe from the split and his moving away?
It is an ongoing process.
Mm.
In my book, Bridges, Reuniting Daughters and Daddies, I have a case study of a father and daughter who had been in reconciliation, had been reconciling for 11 years, and they still hadn't come to a place where they felt that kind of sense of trust and intimacy that one gets from a trusting, loving relationship. They still hadn't arrived at that place. They were still on that journey.
Mm-hmm.
And I think my daughter and her father are still on their journey. The fact that they're able to talk and spend time with each other means that they both care enough about each other to continue on the journey. And so that's a good thing.
Mm. You know, among the advice you offer to women who are suffering from father loss, you say, come out of the closet, and you say, forgive and forget. And I'm curious, how do women connect with other women around fatherlessness? Are there actual support groups, or is it more of a casual kin process of just reaching out? Is there an actual movement?
I think it is. Well, now the fatherhood movement itself has incorporated women in that movement, mm-hmm. more than it was when I first started in the mid-1990s, started dealing with this issue. It was mainly a male, son-dominated movement. Now you have the Annie E. Casey Foundation and, you know, the National Fatherhood Initiative all have female aspects to their programming and to their agenda. And so those are places where women can go to find out what's going on for a greater support. But I would probably tell you, you walk in a room of 20 women, out of that 20, the majority of them had either grown up without their father or they didn't, or they were emotionally disconnected from their fathers. Many of them, especially many of them who are in the age of 30 to 50 or 30 and older. I think it's just now where girls are beginning to develop that kind of close, loving relationship, and the fathers aren't afraid to express that side of their emotion with their children.
Excellent. I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Janetta. This is Women, Body, and Soul, 99.5 FM, WBAI. I want to remind listeners that Janetta Rose Barris's book, Whatever Happened to Daddy's Little Girl, The Impact of Fatherlessness on Black Women, is available at bookstores and online, and that she has a second book on the topic, Reuniting Daughters and Daddies. For more information, go to womenbodyandsoul.com, and you can comment on the show and link directly to Janetta Rose Barris's websites, her column, and her books. Thank you so much for joining us on Women, Body, and Soul, 99.5 FM, WBAI.
Thank you so much, Natalie. I enjoyed it very much. Mm-hmm.
This is Natalie Tandiwe. You're listening to Women, Body, and Soul, WBAI 99.5 FM, New York, streaming live at WBAI.org. Today's Dirty Laundry segment is opting out and copping out of fatherhood. So many mothers complain that they're responsible for parenting 24/7 while dads pursue their own agenda and sign on and off duties selectively. Children with fathers complain that even if dad is in the home, he's unavailable, physically or emotionally, and is on the periphery of family life. In divorced families, mothers and children complain that dads walk or drift away from their children and don't make it a priority to stay connected and parent daily, often moving out of the area or starting new families. Some dads blame their active, proactive parenting on provider roles taking all of their time away from family. Others complain that even when they try to get engaged, moms hover and criticize. Some divorced fathers blame moms for their absence, saying that mothers keep them away. Many mothers, fathers, and children agree that they'd like to experience a different kind of fatherhood, one in which dads are present, co-parents, connected, and valued. Here to talk about reinventing dad are guests Mark Anthony Neal and Bomani Armah. Mark Anthony Neal is a professor of Black popular culture at Duke University and author of New Black Man, Rethinking Black Masculinity, in which he examines the idea of a Black feminist fatherhood. Neal is a regular contributor to TheRoot.com and resides in Durham, North Carolina, with his wife of 18 years and his two adopted daughters. Washington, D.C. educator and musician Bomani Armah uses poetry, hip-hop, music, and video to edutain audiences of all ages and backgrounds. His single Peekaboo on the album Radio Friendly is an homage to the joys of being father to his twin three-year-old boys, Olu and Dela. He performs in New York City, actually next Friday, June 26th, at the OS Art House, 199 Bowery, as part of the Rock Art Hip Hop Showcase. Welcome, Mark and Bomani.
Thank you, Natalie.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much for joining our conversation today, Reinventing Dad, here on WBAI 99.5 FM. You know, given the differences between what the words mothering and fathering mean in the U.S. and globally, where do we begin with reinventing fatherhood, and why does it matter?
Well, I think it matters in part because, you know, when you think about many of the crises that face, you know, Black communities, there's an ongoing narrative about the absence of fathers and fathers not being engaged in the process. I think what we actually see is that there are quite many, you know, Black fathers who are very much committed to parenting and committed to parenting in some out-the-box ways than the kind of traditional stuff that we've seen, you know, represented in popular culture and in society.
Yeah, I would have to agree with him. I think there definitely are a lot of fathers who are interested and active in their children's lives. I think the main issue right now is that it's not a main topic of discussion. I do agree that the fatherhood issue is probably the biggest issue that's attacking the Black community, and I believe that we haven't taken that crisis attitude towards it. I would compare it to the way like the country reacted to World War II. Mm-hmm. Like every song, every movie, every television show, every advertisement had something related to this issue that we all had to galvanize ourselves around. And the Black community, you know, we give lip service to the idea that, yeah, guys need to be fathers, but then the conversation dissipates. And I think, you know, especially Black leadership, I mean, unless you're talking about fatherhood, I don't think you're really talking about anything right now. That's the biggest issue we're dealing with, I believe.
And when you do engage other men in conversations about fatherhood, what kinds of anxieties and frustrations and concerns are they sharing that we might not normally hear about given that silence?
Well, the main thing I'm hearing is something you alluded to in the opening part of the segment, is that there's not enough being said about how difficult the estranged relationship with mothers has on trying to be a father, when you're not in the home.
Mm.
And that there has to be some truth to that. I don't know what the balance is on it, but there has to be some truth to that. And I still think it goes back to the main issue that is not a topic of daily conversation. And I think, you know, brothers for the most part are, you know, don't talk to each other about this. One of the main reasons I did the song and the video for Peekaboo was just to prove that you can be, you know, affectionate and a loving father and talk about it and rap about it, and, you know, your muscles won't shrink, you know, your popularity won't wane. It's really a part of, it's like the ultimate sign of masculinity, because the only thing you leave behind as a legacy really is your children. And so we need to put that in the forefront and find ways to bridge that gap between the mothers and fathers so we can make sure that fathers stay involved in their children's lives.
You know, I think we live in a society that in general does takes a very dim view of fathers. You think about, you know, situation comedies and a range of other things. You know, the fathers are always the figures that are outside of the loop.
Or they're buffoons.
They're buffoons. I mean, literally, that's the way that they're portrayed. And there's an added anxiety around black male fathers because there's always this narrative about black men being absent.
Mm-hmm.
The reality is that, you know, there's a great book that was done a few years ago called Redefining Fatherhood. And what the book actually talks about is that, you know, of those fathers that are not in the household with their children and with the mothers of those children, black fathers typically are much more engaged in the lives of their children than white fathers are. But, you know, but that's not the popular narrative that we hear. And I think for even those fathers that are engaged, there's some real difficulties in day-to-day life, you know, trying to remain engaged in your kids' life, mm-hmm. because daycare providers and teachers and a range of other institutions just take it for granted that fathers aren't interested. You know, I wrote about a new black man, my frustration when my oldest daughter was very young. You know, I'd pick her up from from daycare, and daycare providers, you know, would have very little for me to say. You know, to say to me, you know, I would have to ask all kinds of detailed questions about how her day was. When my wife went to pick her up, you know, they stand there and talk for 25 minutes. And part of that was this assumption that, A, I wasn't interested. And even if I was interested, you know, I didn't have the skill set as a father to really do that kind of serious, engaged parenting, right? And I think the thing that's wonderful about Bomani's video is that it actually shows this side of men, black men in particular, dealing with the idea of parenting and being parents in ways that we rarely see, you know, reflected in the larger society.
Mm. And this sort of silence that Bomani refers to around leadership and discussions of fatherhood, I'm just curious, in the conversations that you're engaged in, Mark, what are some of those anxieties, frustrations, or concerns that you hear men sharing sort of, you know, on the day-to-day, whether it's in the barbershop or just, you know, a man-to-man conversation? And, you know, because these are things that we won't necessarily hear about in the mainstream.
I think for many men, you know, we've bought into a fiction about what masculinity is, right? And part of the, you know, part of what masculinity is this idea of us being the role of financial providers. And I think particularly in the current, you know, economic situation, many men of all classes are struggling. And somehow there's this feeling that we're failing as fathers if we really can't deliver, you know, the goods, if you will, the way that our fathers did and our grandfathers did, et cetera, et cetera. So I hear that a lot, you know, amongst the men, you know, that I travel in, those kind of concerns about economic things. But, you know, many times the conversation really goes to the point that, you know, that's not all we are as fathers, right? There's so many other ways that we can impact the lives of our children beyond simply bringing home a paycheck.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, even for those fathers where, you know, they no longer have a job and have to rethink, you know, what their future is going to be, and now they're the stay-at-home parent,
mm-hmm.
There's always been this kind of feeling that somehow as a stay-at-home father that, you know, you're less of a man, you're less of a human. But I think we're really getting to a critical point now where many men are having to reevaluate how they've been invested in their own masculinity, you know, because they've now had to provide other skill sets in order to be good parents and provide for their families.
And I think you allude to that when you both of you talk about men stepping out of the box with fatherhood. And I'm just curious, beyond the image of the stay-at-home dad, which is really a small percentage of men who are really taking that role on actively, what are other ways that men are sort of bucking the father equals provider or is only valuable as provider? What other sort of roles are they taking on, or ways they're challenging that?
I'm not sure. It is hard to do that. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to, you know, brainstorm or think of ways that I see that happening. But you brought up some very good points. Like, I actually had forgotten until you mentioned it that I had a similar conversation about childcare with my own mother. Like, my mother right now, I love her to death. She's like my sister now. She was a great mother. But one of the first times I dropped off my sons to her, and then I went to pick them up. She asked me some questions about, you know, a rash they had or something like that, and I told her what I thought was going on, and she was like, okay, well, I'll just double check with their mom. And I'm like, but they live with me too, and I'm there all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think she meant to insult me, but it is just kind of the way, you know, mothers are the ones who are completely involved. And I just have to take it on myself to be more involved and to make sure as often as possible I buck that stereotype. I wanted to bring up a point about something you said earlier as far as just the image of fatherhood in America.
Mm-hmm.
The most interesting anecdote for me, especially I deal a lot with young people in the hip-hop community, was an interview that I saw with 50 Cent, and I've been mentioning this often because it really bothered me. When his first album came out, he did an interview on MTV with Sway, and Sway asked him the best question I heard anybody ever ask him. He's like, yo, you've got the hottest album in the country. I listened to it. You have a six-year-old son. There's nothing on your album at all about your six-year-old son. Why is that? And 50 was like, I don't think America wants to hear that from me right now. Now, on his album, he raps all the time about how many times he was shot, about the drug dealing that he did, about, you know, the women that he slept with. But for some reason, he felt that America did not want to hear about 50 Cent, the father. And then just on a simple ability to relate to people, like more people have children than have been shot nine times. So if you're trying to relate to a large audience, even if it's not a good story, you know what I'm saying, just being able to tell that story would help. And the other thing that bothered me was he signed to Eminem's record label. Eminem raps about his children every other song. So what's the difference between Eminem and 50 Cent, where 50 Cent says openly that I don't think America wants to hear that side of me. America is not interested in 50 Cent the father. That's a very limited idea of what black masculinity is, and it's the message that our young people are getting way too often.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the things that folks have found surprisingly refreshing about Snoop's fatherhood. You know, when the show first came on, I mean, you know, part of the commentary was the show that folks were actually shocked, you know, that Calvin Broaddus was so connected in the lives of his children and in many ways was very Cosby-esque, you know,
right,
in the way that he thought about parenting. And it's like, you know, why wouldn't he be? He's a 30-something-year-old grown man. He, at this point in time, he should have an idea about what it means to be a good father. But again, you know, as Bomani, you know, mentioned, that there's just such a very small space in the culture, you know, for the culture to acknowledge that black men can play that role in significant ways.
Yeah, I'm just curious, when we face slippery slopes like, you know, this one where we have the reality of high percentages of fathers leaving their families, you know, via breakups, divorce, abandoning their children, and this is across races, but, you know, there is a disproportionately higher level of this in the African-American community. How do we approach telling the truth and dealing with the message that, telling this truth, but also dealing with this counter message that we're anti-black, or in particular anti-black men, if we speak about this growing failure of fatherlessness and how it's impacting us?
I think we have to qualify the negative aspects of the message. You know, the broad stereotype is that, you know, black fathers are missing, that they're not there. And what that really is about is that black fathers aren't necessarily living in the same households as their children. But that does not necessarily mean that these are black fathers who are not engaged.
Right.
You know, there are lots of examples of fathers who aren't living with the mothers, but, you know, they're the ones who were there, you know, picking up their kids from school 3 o'clock in the afternoon, or dropping them off in the morning, or taking them to basketball practice at the YMCA on the weekends. I think we just have to get better in terms of measuring how fathers who are outside the home choose to engage with their children. And there are many more men engaged in that kind of way than the numbers reflect in terms of black men who are not actually in the household with their...
I would love to see a broader discussion about how fathers are involved. I mean, one of the main reasons I think the conversation gets skewed is when black people want to have an honest conversation about what's going on, we get this, okay, they're white people watching. So we gotta, I mean, that's basically what Jesse Jackson said about Barack Obama's fatherhood speech, you know, that he was calling out black men. And he could have had individual differences with certain points that Barack made, but his overall problem was that he even spoke on the issue.
Right.
And that's the wrong idea. I had an interesting anecdotal experience yesterday talking to one of my best friends. He's married to someone who has two children, and he knows the father of those two children. They aren't his children. He happened to be at a cookout or something with the father of those two children, and he's like, you know, when your sons are with you, their report card and their weekly grades are better than they are when they're with me, because they know you'll discipline them. And the children's biological father was like, I know you're a good man. If you have to discipline them, go ahead. And I was like, wow.
Yeah.
Like, I that was a great conversation.
That's a story we don't hear, right?
Yeah. So, yeah, and actually, these boys who could have had no fathers now have two of them.
Right.
And so I thought that was very inspirational, and I'm hoping that people start having this open dialogue on what parenting is in our community, so we can start working out these issues.
Yeah, I want to open the conversation about fatherhood and sexism, or on the other side, feminism. And I'm just wondering, how has fatherhood affected how you view the mainstream tendency to protect and preserve the image or the livelihood of men who abuse women or are accused of exploiting girls? You know, for example, Mike Tyson or R. Kelly or Woody Allen. And, you know, I know since I've thrown Woody Allen there, we have to talk about racism as well in looking at these examples.
I mean, that's a great question. You know, fundamentally, you know, and I've long considered myself a male who was influenced by feminist thought. But that, you know, that got very serious, you know, when I suddenly have daughters and have to take in consideration in my everyday actions and the actions of my peers and the actions of the society, you know, how that society is going to deal with them as young black girls and hopefully young black women at some point. And so I had to take, you know, very seriously how they navigate the world, right? And in what ways is there a difficulty in them navigating that world because of the reality of sexism, misogyny, and became more important for me to really deal and acknowledge that reality and combat it where I can, but also to instill in them a sense of how they can flow through the world, you know, based on who they are, and bringing them into the conversation about, you know, gender distinctions and sexuality distinctions. For me, it's really just heightened my sense of why it's important to be committed to an egalitarian society that's pro-feminist and anti-homophobic, et cetera.
Mm. And Bomani, you know, being the father of sons, I'm curious how fatherhood has, you know, shaped your conversation and your thought around sexism and feminism.
I know for a fact, like my sons are three. Mm-hmm. I know, like, right, even when they were one and a half and first could learn to speak, some of my relatives were uncomfortable that they knew the anatomical names for all their body parts. But that's something I wanted to start with and make sure I had open and honest conversation. I want to make sure, because sex is so prevalent and, you know, what man and female relationships are so prevalent in popular society and culture, I wanted to make sure I beat them to the punch as far as having those conversations with my children. But then to go to the question you were asking about, you know, sexism and, you know, the R. Kelly and Mike Tyson situation. The R. Kelly situation to me, it really exposed to me what must be the reality of black women's sexual experience. Because the reason black women didn't throw him overboard in mass is because a lot of them must have saw the situation. It was like, okay, a 14-year-old girl and a 30-year-old man. I've seen that
right,
in there before.
Right.
This is not news to me. This is the way it goes. So they didn't react. And so that really shows you where we are as a society dealing with sex. And it really shows that we need to be more open and honest about the conversation so we can start working through these details.
You know, I also want to open up our line to listener calls. If you want to join us in this conversation on reinventing fatherhood, you can call us at 212-209-2900. That's 212-209-2900. And I just want to remind you that we're speaking with Mark Anthony Neal, author of New Black Man, Rethinking Black Masculinity, as well as musician Bomani Arma. His album is radio friendly and includes the single Peekaboo. That's 212-209-2900 if you want to join our conversation. And, you know, the other thing that's interesting, I think this goes back to some of what especially Mark was saying earlier about, you know, race and fatherhood in that conversation, is that when we have issues of, you know, Mike Tyson, R. Kelly, and then there's someone like a Woody Allen who pops up and marries his adopted daughter, the conversation is very different. And I know that some of this is about the race of these women and girls, and it's also about the race of these men. And I'm curious, is that something that men are talking about?
I think, you know, as a father with two daughters, you know, I talk all the time, you know, my daughters are 10 and 6, mm-hmm. about, you know, their relationship with young men in their lives, right? The idea that there should be this notion of personal space, you know, that as a young girl, you know, and when they're teenagers down the road, you know, you just don't walk up to some man that you don't know and crowd his physical space, because then that suggests something else. I think all those kinds of issues, I was a big R. Kelly fan and really had to give pause, you know, when the case went down, because, you know, is this a man that I would want to be in the same room with my own daughters? I think in terms of race, you know, again, it's so much easier for us to buy into the notion of black men as being deviant in this regard. And the reality is that, you know, while, you know, this, you know, R. Kelly's example may be more widespread in black communities than we want to admit, the reality is that they're also very much widespread in other communities in this country.
Absolutely. And we actually have a caller on the line, so we're going to take a call. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hi. My name is Marie.
Hi, Marie. And your question today?
I wanted to ask if you and the other people on the program would speak about Minister Farrakhan's Million Man March and, you know, how they felt that it influenced male parenting.
And just after my read of New Black Man, I'm curious, Mark, do you want to take the lead on that question?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay.
You know, at the time I was very critical of the march, not because of the spirit of the march, but the idea that we would think that responsibility for black men in the black community would take place in the context of a men's only gathering. You know, I think if we're going to talk about the role that black men has in terms of taking responsibility as parents, as partners, you know, in black communities, that has to be a much more broad conversation, right, in which, yes, we can articulate and self-critique what our problems are, but also to do the kind of work to take the very hard critique that might be coming from black women about what we're failing to do. I think if there was something that we could say that was a downside of the Million Man March, again, despite all the great feelings that day, is that there really wasn't a social network set up in black communities to really follow through with some of the stated goals and the grand themes of the march that would resonate throughout communities. I think as we take a look back now, some 14 years, clearly it's a moment that pushes the conversation in the public in ways that it hadn't been before, right?
And only because we have so many people calling in, and I want to give other people a chance to get their questions. We could go on about this for a long time. I want to take another...
Can I make just a quick point about the Million Man March? I was 17 when the Million Man March happened. And just the ability to see that many black men together was monumental. There was definitely a lot of fall off that happened, but I didn't really care who was organizing it. Flavor Flav could have been organizing it. If you was getting a million black men, I stepped on so many gators that day and didn't get into one fight. Like, it was crazy, and it was very, very
inspirational. Hold that thought so we can take another call. Hi, caller, you're on the air. Your name and your question.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air. Your name and your question?
Yes, good morning. My name is Melvin, and I'm calling from East Harlem.
Hi, welcome, Melvin. And your question today?
My question is that I would like to, for your guests to talk a little bit or more about government's involvement. I think that is one of the greatest detriments to the black family. As you know, a lot of times when women are receiving assistance and things like that, the man can't be in the house. So they are indirectly responsible for breaking up a lot of families, even...
Okay, and we're going to actually just take that part of your question because we have so many callers. We're going to take it off the air. You can both address that, either of you, you know, if anyone feels most passionate about it.
I've actually been hearing a lot about that, and it's something I've been investigating myself because I've been hearing, just doing the investigation to promote, you know, the music that I'm doing and the conversations I'm trying to start about fatherhood, and I'm hearing a lot of fathers saying that it's in the mother's best interest to be detached from the father for government purposes. I'm not sure how true that is. But I also, sometimes I think we get too focused on how outside influences from our community affect us. Like, I think we have enough leeway in the way this government works that if we start concentrating and start talking amongst each other, we can find the solutions without completely blaming or pointing outside of our circle as far
and
as what's going on.
Because we have so many people calling, and I want to also let people know you can leave your comments online if you don't get through at womenbodyandsoul.com. That's www.womenbodyandsoul.com. And I want to take one more call. Hi, welcome. You're on the air. Your name and your question?
Yeah, my name is Sweet, and I don't really have a question. There's so much was said, but I myself was a single father of a daughter. And it was a teaching experience for both of us. And she's now a chemical engineer, graduated Spelman College.
Congratulations.
And, it was an interesting time in my life, and I belong to a church that has a men's ministry that encourages St. Paul Community Baptist Church, which encourages men to be responsible and have relationships with their fathers so that they can improve that situation. And I think that the Million Man March did have an impact in that I see a lot of differences in relationships since then.
And only because we have so little time left, I'm going to thank you so much for your comment. And do either of you gentlemen have any comments you want to make in closing or in response to that?
The most interesting thing, I don't have a daughter yet, maybe one day. The most interesting thing I ask my friends who have daughters is, what are you going to do when a guy comes to your door who reminds you of yourself, who's your daughter? And I'm hoping, I want to find a way to phrase that question for 15, 16, 17-year-olds, because that really changes your whole
perspective. Write a song.
How you treat, you know, women around you. So, yeah.
And I just want to thank both of you for joining us on the air, and I want to thank the listeners for tuning in with us. Our guests today were Junetta Rose Barris earlier at the top of the hour, and Mark Anthony Neal and Bomani Armah join us now. To link to their books and music, you can go to womenbodyandsoul.com. We're also doing a giveaway of both books, one of Whatever Happened to Daddy's Little Girl and the other one of New Black Man by Mark Anthony Neal. If you'd like to enter the giveaway, you can email us at info@womenbodyandsoul.com or go to womenbodyandsoul.com and leave a comment to enter. And I just want to remind everyone that hip-hop artist Bomani Armah is performing in New York City Friday, June 26th at the OS Art House, 199 Bowery, as part of the Rock Art and Hip-Hop Showcase. If you go to womenbodyandsoul.com, you can link to Bomani's website and events. And I just want to thank both of you gentlemen for joining us. This is the second in a series of Father's Day shows that we did around fatherhood, and it's been a great conversation. We've gotten a lot of response. And thanks so much for joining us, WBAI 99.5 FM, WBAI.org, streaming online.
Thank you, Natalie.
Thank you.
WBAI.
Wow, sounds weird.
Weird, but I like it.
I like it.
What is it?
It's WBAI.
I like it.
Did you honor your pledge?
To go low carb?
To send money to WBAI.
Well, you mean write a check?
Yeah, I mean write a check.
I wrote it.
Well, now send it.
Oh, send it.
To WBAI.
120 Wall Street.
New York, New York.
10005.
WBAI. I like it.
Yeah!
Hello, listeners. You're all invited to the Great Hudson River Clearwater Revival June 20th and 21st at Croton Point Park. Pete Seeger, Rich Havens, Arlo Guthrie, and Taj Mahal are among the headliners. There won't be live coverage this year, so you're going to have to be there to experience it. Do yourself a favor. Treat yourself. At the same time, support Pete's vision of a way to help save our planet. So get your tickets for the festival by logging on to www.clearwater.org or calling 503-265-2270. That's 503-265-2270.
And you're tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI, and WBAI.org on the web. Good afternoon. My name is Michael G. Haskins, your radio host and guide. Coming up next will be The Positive Mind with Armand DeMille, trying to help you lead a more positively minded life. Before we go to that, here's an important reminder to members of the WBAI listening community. Nominations are now open for candidates seeking election to our local station board. To vote in this year's election or to run as a candidate, you must become a member of WBAI no later than June 30th. The only requirement for membership is a donation of $25 to this listener-sponsored station. If you have not yet done so, please renew your membership or to become a member by making a $25.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.